The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the last in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, you may remember that last week I wanted to read the famous vision of Isaiah about the time when there would be no more war, because I said that that was the climax of all the views that the Bible took of war and, if you please, of peace and justice and democracy, too. And I said that the ultimate tribute that we could pay the Bible would be to say that it had everything in it. But it certainly would not have... We couldn't say it had everything in it if it didn't have this. And you said at the moment that you would rather save that great passage. Is it time to read it now?
Yes, I'd like you to.
Because we still might forget, or time might pass.
Yes, read it now, Mark, will you?
Well, it's terribly moving. And it shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills. And all the nations shall flow into it, and many people shall go and say, Come, let us go up unto the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge between the nations, and shall decide for many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn any more war.
I think that's the greatest piece of prose in all world literature, if one can use the word literature.
I don't see how you can surpass it.
In this connection, the most significant of all the utterances that have ever been made. And almost each one of the sentences tempts you to long thought and scrutiny and meditation. Take, for instance, this one passage. Many nations shall go and say, Come, let us go up unto the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. The ancient Jewish dream, or the dream of the Israelite people, people of Judea of that time, was not to conquer the world and impose its will upon the world, but to have the world come and learn. And I contrast this with the great Roman ideal. There was a great Roman ideal, the golden age that Virgil foresaw. Now, we don't know whether Virgil ever read the Bible, but people have suggested he did come under the influence of some biblical thought, perhaps via some Sibylline books. He died something, I don't know, just around a few years before the Common Era. And he had his dreams of the perfect time. You remember in the fourth eclogue, that passage which he addresses to the son of his patron, Asinius Pollio.
Yes.
He talks of the time, for thee, child, the untilled earth shall pour forth her gifts. The herds shall not fear huge lions. The serpent, too, shall perish. On this, by the way, Tennyson wrote that very wonderful poem on Virgil's 2000th anniversary, in which he spoke of the summers of the snakeless meadow, unlaborious earth, and oarless sea. And then Virgil goes on in that eclogue, a second warfare too there shall be, and again a great Achilles sent to Troy. Hmm. In other words, his dream was not of a world from which war had been banished. It was a world in which everything was wonderful, no labor had to be done, but there were wars to be won and the glory to be achieved. Or again, in an equally famous passage toward the end of the sixth book of the Aeneid, you remember that infinitely moving passage where young Marcellus, who died beautiful, beloved, and young, is evoked from among the shades.
Yes.
And Virgil says of him, this is he that shall set up again the golden age in Latium, and shall spread his empire beyond Garamant and India to a land that lies beyond the stars. And then, remember thou, O Roman, to rule the nations with thy sway. These shall be thine arts, to crown peace with law, to spare the humbled, and to tame in war the proud. Again,
yeah.
No vision of a warless world any more than there is in the first of the great utopias, the Republic of Plato. It is a world with war in it.
Yes, and of course the Romans did manage to keep some kind of order in the world longer than any other people have ever done it, through their might. The Roman peace, which was of course a peace by strength, a peace with legions, lasted a long, long time, and it is, some say, a great achievement. But you can't forget the terrible thing that Tacitus said. They made a wilderness and called it peace.
Yes, that was, yes, yes. Yes, when Trajan came back from the conquest of Dacia, by the way, Romania, my birthplace.
Yes. Is that the same thing?
That's the territory. He had pacified the country by simply obliterating the inhabitants.
Yes.
And that's what called forth his bitter remark of Tacitus.
Yes, specifically.
The Pax Romana was a tremendous achievement. It lasted certainly for something like 2.5 centuries, let us say, from the time of Augustus until the time of Commodus, the son of Marcus Aurelius. But then there were wars always on the borders. It wasn't an age of peace in the world. There were wars always on the borders. Marcus Aurelius fighting the Marcomanni, Trajan conquering Mesopotamia and dreaming of going down as far as India. But within a territory that stretched from the wall in Scotland, the wall of Hadrian, as far as Mauritania in Spain, in North Africa, and as far as somewhat beyond the Jordan, there was comparative peace.
You know, we look back on certain passages of peace in history with great longing and great love. I'm sure the reason that the English people loved Elizabeth so much, finally, was that there had been no wars in her reign. She was queen...
Victoria.
No, Elizabeth.
Which Elizabeth?
The first Elizabeth. For 50 or 60 years, you see, there were no wars. That was
there was the invasion of the Armada.
No, it was not a war. It didn't happen.
It was an attempted war.
Yes, but it didn't happen. And Lytton Strachey has been very amusing about that in his book, I think, Elizabeth and Essex. He said the reason that there was no war was that Elizabeth could never make up her mind. You know, she was a very difficult old girl. Her counselors and her ministers were always trying to move her into war, but she could never come to it. She always put them off and said, "We'll wait a while." Well, she waited for 60 years, and that is the great time. That was a great time.
Yes, that was a tremendously decisive indecision.
You know, sometimes I think, and we've said this before, I think, this summer, one of the wisest things to do at certain moments is nothing.
Well, it takes a great deal of character to do that. But it must not be an uncreative nothing.
That's true.
It must be something like space as it is now conceived. You know, space was supposed to be something completely empty. Now that we know that space itself, empty space, as we used to call it, is full of vibrations of something or other.
Full of electricity.
Full of electricity. The problem of taking a creatively restful or... a peaceful attitude is one of the very high achievements of a civilized mind. This is what the Bible was aiming at in that ultimate dream of a world in which they will have learned, not it will have been imposed upon them, that they will have learned to walk in his paths. And going back again to that remark that you made in the last our last conversation, there has to be some authority which will say, thus and thus, the thing has to be settled, and war is as unthinkable between, let us say, England, America, and Russia, as it is between New York and New Jersey. We're having disputes here about the allocation of taxes. People who live in New Jersey, well, who dreams of people taking up arms and rushing upon each other?
Yeah, because it would then be a crime, a federal crime, for that to happen. Well, Maurice, let me say, this may be quite parenthetical, but it pleases me to consider it. The word walk is suddenly very interesting to me. Isaiah speaks of walking in his paths, and Amos speaks of walking humbly with thy God, walking with God, walking in the straight way. The word comes in over and over again, and remember in Genesis, God walked in the garden. Not marching, not running, not hurling oneself just walking. What a wonderful word.
Yes, you hit upon something that comes very close to the heart of our subject. In Hebrew, the verb to walk, lalechet or halach, has been turned into the phrase halacha, which means the law, or the way a man should go in life.
But isn't that nice? I didn't know that.
You get this curious sublimation of the word, that walking also indicates, as it were, a man's philosophy, a man's lawful going about his occasions. And this lawful behavior is called the going, halacha, the walking.
So the world might be saved today if someone could get the attention of all mankind and say, let's take a walk.
Yes. To walk peaceably together. Shall two walk together if they disagree?
Yes.
The prophet asks. In other words, if you go hand in hand with somebody, it must be peacefully. Otherwise, there can't be any walking together.
Yeah, or walking together arguing about things, you know. And, you know, maintaining positions and so forth. That's good, too, to go back to what I was saying. I don't mean fighting. I don't mean combating one another. But endeavoring, as you said yourself, to arrive at the truth. Because
may be some psychological quirk in this, that when you're walking, you're physically occupied, and any excess of animal spirits that might tempt you to become combative is absorbed by the walking.
Yes.
So while you walk, you can talk.
It's a modicum of exercise.
Now, the real essence of our year's conversation this during this summer lies in this walking through democracy and the Bible, and examining the concurrence of ideas, the interplay that there is between these two worlds of discourse, the attempt to determine for ourselves and to move our listeners to determine to what degree there is an utter interdependability between the biblical and the democratic outlook. Now, I feel that because we've taken some time considering these things and coming together to talk freely to each other, I have reached a deeper feeling with regard to what I at first felt more or less instinctively when we proposed the subject. And now it begins to develop in my mind as something worth much consideration from the religious, the biblical point of view, and from the point of view of civic relations. We shall not get anywhere in a complete divorce, or in any kind of divorce between these two. It raises the great problem, the great practical problem of what we call church and state, about the government interfering in the activities of a particular creed or of a particular organizational form of religion. There are many people who are under the impression that this implies that the country is irreligious.
Yes.
That the government is qua government without a religion. I think this is a very false view.
Yes, I've always remembered J.K. Chesterton's remark. Says, freedom of religious discussion was intended to mean that everyone could talk about religion as much as he pleased. It turns out to mean that nobody is permitted to mention it.
Well,
isn't that what you mean?
Yes. Isn't it queer how people say, now, that's a controversial subject.
That's right.
Let's keep away from it. Now, the habit of keeping away from controversial subjects is the biggest breeder of controversies. It means that people...
Well, now you're exactly on the track that I was trying to keep a week or so ago. Controversy. The avoidance of controversy in the belief that That somehow or other peace comes in that from that source. It seems to me absurd. Controversy by all means, controversy and argument and colloquium, and as we say, the meeting of minds, not the meeting of minds head on with the idea that one mind should destroy the other, but meeting in order to achieve the truth.
Well, we're getting back to the verse that you quoted some talks ago, that a man should not bear a grudge against his neighbor, but thou shalt rebuke thy neighbor, and thou shalt not keep hatred in thy heart. Yes. That is to say, that when there is this feeling that you are in disagreement, let it be known.
Let it be known, my own.
This suppression of disagreement, this sweeping of disagreements under the carpet, is simply the accumulation of hatreds.
Disagreement and agreement, of course, are great terms. There's nothing sweeter than agreement, and it's what we all want, and it's what I think we all talk for the purpose of agreement. I'm troubled sometimes by people these days who think that any discussion that takes place between two or three or more men should have, as they say, lots of disagreement in it.
Yes.
As if disagreement were a thing and a good in itself. It's not a good in itself.
Yes.
It's only good if it leads to agreement. Assuming
you were talking before about walk, the word to walk with all of the aura of implications that attends it. Also the word sit has that. There's the famous verse, Matovu manaim shevet achim gam yachad. That is, how good and how pleasant it is for brothers to sit together in agreement. Now, you don't imagine them just sitting around nodding at each other and saying, yes, you're perfectly right, yes, you're perfectly right. It is presumed that they're sitting there discussing matters, agreeing and disagreeing and moving on from point to point. You know, the
walking and talking and sitting, maybe those are the three things.
Those comprise, instead of the, we might substitute this now, instead of the old, the properly honored three great pillars of the world, which are supposed to be Torah and religious service and doing of good deeds. We'll have walking, talking, and sitting.
Yeah.
We'll substitute those. The dream, the poetical dream, which the old traditional Jewish type of thinking has projected on the world, is that we will be sitting forever in the academy on high. They talk about the Shiva Shalmala, the academy on high, as in contradistinction to the Shiva Shalmata, academy below, where we sit forever studying and evolving from the letters of the Torah infinitudes of meaning, and infinitudes being inexhaustible, that for aeons and aeons we will go on taking our delight in the expounding and exfoliation of wisdom from the sacred books.
And the worst thing perhaps that we could say about war, as we know war, is that it stops communication, is that we cease to talk beyond the border of the enemy.
In war, people don't walk, they run.
Yes.
They don't sit, they lie down. And they don't talk, they shout.
Yes, or shoot.
In complete contradiction to what we've looked upon as a good,
Maurice,
as a good life.
Do you think, as we've considered this great topic this summer, we've hit upon all the major elements in it? I rather think we have, and I'm not congratulating ourselves when I say so, but I can hardly conceive of any topics more important under the general topic than the sanctity of the person, which, remember, we preferred to the dignity of the individual, and yet it might be the same thing, and I'd be willing to settle for either. Equality, because I think equality remains basic to all good thought about the relations between men. It's the only view which permits us to truly to understand one another, I should say.
Well, Mark, it's very likely that we're going to have this year the same experience that we've had all the other years, that we'll say afterwards, oh, we didn't talk about this. Oh, we didn't talk about that.
Well, is there something?
Each of these subjects that we've raised here after we meditated them and then came together to have these conversations Each of these subjects can be expanded into a dozen subjects. At the moment, I can't think of anything we've left out. But I won't guarantee this feeling of satisfaction a week from now or a month from now. Let's start all over again. We could do so much better.
And, of course, there was that infinitely famous sentence that we kept on repeating, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." I'm not sure but what that was as central to our topic as anything else, wouldn't you say so? Because out of that springs the idea of equality, out of that springs peace.
You notice that the very wonderful thing there is, a man should love himself.
Yes, of course he should.
Otherwise he can't love anybody else. That's love true. Thy neighbor as thyself. And in this problem of loving yourself, you've got an infinitude of perplexities. What love of oneself means. Does it mean that you just take pleasure in existing and that you consider the world a sort of instrument for your delight? Or does it mean loving yourself carries with it that the love of the self is impossible unless you love other people too?
Yes, of course, it works that way.
I remember...
Just as you can't love other people if you can't love yourself, so you can't love yourself unless you can love other people. It goes that way. In other words, the ultimate sign that one loves oneself truly and properly is that one does not think about oneself. Self-obsession disappears altogether.
Yes, now at the very close, you see, we are talking now of these ultimate values. Notice that we have almost irresistibly moved into an area in which democracy hasn't yet found the proper language. That which we call democracy, so far, is obviously in a primitive stage, inasmuch as we've had to keep on referring to matters not formulated in any democratic creed. They are seeds now lying in the democratic outlook, which have to find, let me use the word provisionally, secular expression.
Mm-hmm.
There is a problem here of bringing into harmony the civic and the religious outlook. Very far from saying that a country which in which church is separated from state is an irreligious country, we have the creative paradox of a country which is intensely religious and yet in which church and state are separated, in which we strive to implant the religious feeling and the religious outlook in human beings and yet at no time intrude the civic upon the religious, although the civic is interfused with the religious outlook. People talk about separation of church and state as though it were a very simple matter. It's a highly complicated one. And it is one which we won't solve until we have made such an agreement in our minds between the democratic view of life and the biblical view of life that the two are harmoniously interfused.
Yes, and one sign that they were interfused might be that our rulers do more than just run the country. You know, sometimes you hear the President of the United States referred to as the man who runs the country. That always bothers me.
Now, we've agreed not to like the word run anyhow.
That's true. Yes, maybe we should say he walks with the country.
Yes.
But this phrase always troubles me because it suggests that the country is nothing but a machine which someone cranks up and keeps going. And oftentimes that's the way it is discussed. A discussion of economic and political things sometimes sounds that way. We even call parties political machines and so forth. But we always remember that our great presidents, to take only our own case here in America, our great presidents have been men who seem to teach us. They're not merely runners.
Yes, we want as president a man of whom we say that is the spirit of America.
Yes.
Not just a man. He's very capable. He's very able. We would like to say of him in the last analysis, and I come back to the word walk, which is used so beautifully in the passage in Micah, to walk humbly with thy God. You know what has been asked of you, to walk humbly with thy God and to love justice and mercy.
Yes.
We would like to think of a president of whom the world says, as the world says, let us say, of Abraham Lincoln, There was the image of a man which the world can take to its heart everywhere.
Yes, I was thinking of him. I was thinking of the fact that he was called Father Abraham, and I think that was not the ordinary paternal.
In spite of the fact that we speak of Washington as the father of his country, it is Father Abraham that we refer to. And of course, that was done because Father Abraham, the biblical figure, the father of the Jewish people.
Yeah, it's quite wonderful that Lincoln did have that name. You know, it suddenly occurs to me, and this is amazing, that a very famous American poem is by Rachel Lindsay, and it's called Abraham Lincoln Walks at Midnight.
Yes. All of these concepts that we have of democracy and the Bible should find their, personification in a president, but let me say they should be corporealized in a country. And this was the dream of the Jewish people of old, talked of itself, ideally speaking, as a nation of priests. It meant that the people as such will have passed beyond this strain between the kitchen business of the earth. Government is the kitchen business of the earth. Now, the actual food is the religious feeling in man. And the harmonization of these two is the only dream that we can have in a world which will fulfill both the biblical and the democratic ideals.
And I'm so glad to have you say, as you did a moment or so ago, that the problem may be the problem of reducing all this to, or translating all this into secular language. Let's say, put it into the language used by men, which, by the way, the Bible did. The Bible is spoken in the language used by men, and that's why, that's whence comes this wonderful
power. Well, of course, everywhere, God said unto Moses, speak unto the children of Israel.
Yes. Yes, it's perfectly simple. Well then, Maurice, I suppose we, at the end of this conversation that's been running on all summer, we can say to each other that we're now prepared to walk out together in peace.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the last program in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us next week when the Eternal Light will begin a series of four programs with Maurice Samuel entitled Certain People of the Book. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.